got music in me, yeah, yeah. Ooh, I got the music in me. I truly got the music in me.
This is Comics Therapy, episode 59. No reviews, just analysis. I'm Aaron Myers, and my co-host, as always, is Andrea Schauchling. Up this week, two comics from September 17th, 2014. Edge of the Spider-Verse number 2, Gwen Stacy, Spider-Woman, and The Wicked and the Divine number 4. On the couch, we welcome writer Sean E. Williams, and in between segments, listen to another second opinion. Just as a reminder, we never do reviews, but we do talk a lot. So there may be spoilers ahead.
If I was Gwen Stacy, I'd be super sad about the way you totally fucked up her title.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it wasn't super long and awkward or anything.
Just saying.
Well, good thing she's not a real character or person.
You're ruining everything.
Hi, I'm Matt Baum. I'm one half of the Two-Headed Nerd. You can find me on Twitter under Matt Baumstein. And I'm sending an MP3 for this week's second opinion. I started reading comics when I was 7 years old. It was crazy. The first comics I read were EC knockoffs, like Weird Mystery Tales, and I quickly got into a bunch of the old EC books, too, because my parents weren't paying enough attention to what I was collecting at the time. And I loved horror comics. I loved them. Even as a little kid, I loved them. And I found a pile of them at a garage sale once, convinced my mom to let me buy them. In that pile was also some Spider-Man and some Captain America, and those flipped my lid. And I've been a Marvel guy ever since. But yeah, started with really weird horror comics, Spidey and Cap.
Welcome to Comics Therapy. Neither Aaron nor I are licensed therapists, so don't take anything we say seriously. The theme this week, if music be the food of love, play on. For centuries, music has been a focus and an outlet for friends, fools, and foes alike. It's a shared passion that brings us together like few other things can. It's a distraction from pain and an opportunity for greatness. Every musician dreams of hitting it big. Becoming a star or becoming a god? We're looking at two books this week where music and character intertwine, and where gods and mortals do too.
Let's see. Most of the comics I read, I'm forced to read for the show, whether I like them or not, for review purposes. But I typically don't buy Marvel and DC comics anymore physically. I'll read them digitally. Anything, I made a rule basically saying that I'm not going to buy comics that have ads interrupting the stories anymore. Which means I'm buying a lot more small press stuff, Image stuff, even some Dark Horse stuff. I'll never stop buying the Mignola Universe stuff. I just love it too much. But I do like to read comics on my iPad. There is still a part of me that very much loves to read the actual comic book itself, and I will never stop buying some of those. And I'll always be a fool for old Doctor Strange and Daredevil issues. My local comic shop is, of course, the Eisner Award-winning Legend Comics and Coffee. If I say otherwise, my co-host will beat me up.
Each
episode...
No, it says Andrea. I get to read it.
All right.
Each episode, in between comic segments, you'll hear one listener answering a series of questions, sharing his or her favorite comics, creators, and more. We call it a second opinion. The prompts are on the website, comicstherapy.com. So if you want to leave your own response for us to use on a future show, you can. Call, Skype, or email. Remember to read comics responsibly, kids. And always get a second opinion.
In between shows, you can find me on Twitter at Aaron Myers and Andrea at Andrea Schauch. The show account is at Comics Therapy.
Hi.
So, hey, what's up?
How you feeling?
Better.
God, thank you. You are the fucking worst when you are sick. It's pathetic.
I would never have agreed to this theme if I had been lucid.
Really?
I don't even know what this means.
We're talking about books that have music in them. How hard is this?
Ugh. Really hard.
It's not, considering there were actually more than two choices this week.
I guess. I think I was taken advantage of in a moment of weakness.
That was your entire week, dear.
Well, that's my entire life.
Yep.
Really? That should be on my tombstone.
Taken advantage of in a moment of weakness?
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating, considering you try to, like, portray yourself as this, like, powerful, guy who makes all the choices. Everyone else is like second to you because you're in charge.
What? Who are you talking about?
Wait.
What life do you think I'm living?
Different Aaron Myers, it must be.
I guess so. Yeah, this is not correct. It's been a long week, but I don't think my life changed that much.
Oh, man. But you're doing better? Boys are doing better?
Boys are fine. It's really hard to recover from a cold with little kids. Mm-hmm. I feel I will be con-worthy in a couple of days.
Oh, hey! Is that what you're doing this weekend, huh?
By the time people hear this, it has been done.
Oh, right. Because you've already announced that you're going to be super late. Because you're going to go gallivanting off to Portland.
That is correct.
Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah. So, I'm looking forward to it. I've got quite a list of people I want to see. I don't think I'm going to do that much comic shopping.
Really?
Cons?
Dude, just told me last week that I was doing cons wrong. And so now you're saying maybe you were too?
Well, I'll buy comics from creators.
Okay, got it.
But I'm not going to go to the vendors.
Oh, yeah, because cons are a terrible place to buy comics, like, at a good price.
It depends. Depends what you're looking for. I think for a lot of people, they're good because they don't have comic shops necessary, or comic shops with a lot of backstock, you know, in their area. So when a con comes, or they go to a con, that's like their chance to like fill in runs, you know. It's just not practical to try to do it online a lot of the time. Right. So you can. It just, for me, I have a lot of comics options here in Eugene, so it doesn't really...
Oh, do you? I don't feel like you've ever told me about those before.
No, I kind of keep that close to the vest.
Right.
But it's true. So, yeah, I don't know. There's a couple things I'll keep an eye out for that I haven't found locally and that I don't want to deal with the eBay stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, key books that if I find something I really want, maybe I'd buy. But I think for the most part, it's going to be pretty busy. There's a long list of creators I want to see.
This is just a 2-day con, right? Like, you're going for both of the days and it's only Saturday and Sunday?
Yes.
Awesome.
So, I'll be there all day Saturday, stay at a hotel right next to the convention center, and go Sunday most of the day, and then come home.
Cool. I'm going to Tahoe, so have fun.
Yeah, well, you too, I guess.
Yeah, I've never been there. I have no idea what to expect. I feel like everybody in the Bay Area goes to Tahoe, and it has this, like, capitalization, like, we're going to Tahoe. Like, what the fuck even is that? But this weekend, I'm going to Tahoe, and... Apparently, it's going to take me 100 years to get there, and when I get there, it will be full of tourists. So, goodness gracious, can't wait for that one.
I mean, the lake is beautiful.
That's cool. That's an exciting thing. I hope I get to see it.
I hope so, too. You're going there for a hockey tournament, right? So, your team is playing?
What is this, my team?
I don't know.
Like,
I didn't even know you played hockey.
I don't anymore. I used to.
Oh. So, you're just going, like, as a cheerleader?
Gosh, have I ever mentioned there's a person in my life who plays quite a bit of hockey? I feel like maybe also, like, your comic books, that's perhaps come up before.
Oh, see, I forgot a lot in the time I was sick.
Oh, you were
it's
sick?
Good to get, it's kind of good to touch base.
I didn't remember that you
just
were
about
sick.
What's going on in your life.
You only mentioned it every fucking day, like 20 times every time I was like, hey, Aaron, blah. Hey, Aaron, blah. Hey, no, I'm sick. I'm sick.
So Tahoe's really nice.
Yeah, I have a little bit of pent-up aggression, I feel.
Yeah, I don't, not towards me. I think this is projecting.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Tahoe's awesome. I'm excited. But yeah, Avi has a hockey tournament. So that is...
Well, hopefully you get to see the lake at some point.
Yes, that would be great.
Mm-hmm. Well, enjoy. That's all I have to say to you.
Thanks, Aaron.
Mm-hmm. Other than that, that is my life, and hopefully it's good.
Comics and sick kids.
Yeah, the thing about cons is the sickness that comes along with them, though.
Oh, goodness.
That seems unavoidable.
Okay, I mean, yes, I agree, but for my sake, I really hope that you wash your hands and don't inhale anybody else's germs, because I can't handle another week of you being sick, like, right after this one.
Yeah, me either, so...
Like, for my sake.
I don't know, break out the,
hand sanitizer.
Contingency plans.
What?
Well, no, you know, the emergency contingency plans. Like, you activate my LMD, and you just have to kind of wing the show.
That sounds fine. Okay. New co-host.
Yeah.
Those are always my favorite episodes.
Great. So look forward to that, everyone. We could talk about comics this week while I still have energy.
Okay.
Because I was sick. I don't know if you know that. I'm still recovering.
Oh, you were sick? Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Mm-hmm.
While you were ill, I decided that we were going to talk about comics and music. Did I tell you that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Did you?
We'll see.
Did you totally
we'll see how that goes.
Actually sign off on it in writing?
I doubt I did.
You did. You did.
If anything, I went K and like went back to sleep.
Right.
Yeah.
Start us off.
So, let's do it.
My favorite current running series right now, probably Jason Aaron's Thor. I'm a huge Thor guy. I always have been. And I love what he's done with the character. I love that they're shaking things up with the female Thor stepping in. And it's just been too much fun. It's great art. It is a perfect example of what a big two superhero comic should be. Great story, great art, and no rules. They're willing to shake it up, and I really like that.
Our first book this week is Edge of Spider-Verse, number 2, Gwen Stacy, Spider-Woman. It's written by Jason Latour, with art by Robbie Rodriguez. It's colored by Rico Renzi and lettered by Clayton Coles. Edge of Spider-Verse, number 2, is published by Marvel Comics, and is a precursor to the upcoming Spider-Verse event.
This is a standalone issue, sort of a what-if-style version of the Spider-Man mythos, with Gwen Stacy in the hero role and Peter Parker as the fallen friend. It's kind of all you need to know. Gwen plays drums in an up-and-coming band, the Mary Janes, because of course she does. And it was adorable.
Yep. I do find it funny how the internet freaks out and says, oh my god, we have to have more of this.
Why?
Well, because I think that's a natural reaction to stuff like this. Like these kind of, I just call them Elseworlds, even though that's technically just DC. Mm-hmm. I just think it's a good blanket term for the kind of alternate reality stuff.
Whereas I said what if, because that's what Marvel does?
Yeah, I know, but in my mind, I just always call them Elseworlds.
Whatever.
But I think too much of that just makes it just another comic. Like, I think we love it because it's like, yeah, it's that one-off of, you know, something, flipping all the roles, reversals, and everything like that. If I make it continuous and ongoing and mainstream, then it loses that magic.
You think that would actually happen with this?
Look what happened to Spider-Girl.
Okay.
Spider-Girl started out as a what-if comic.
Okay.
And then they did a Spider-Girl series because everyone loved it. And I mean, it lasted somewhat, but it's not like people are dying for more Spider-Girl.
Do you think that part of the problem, though, is that it's just a reinvention of something that's already established? Like, do you think
it's just flipping roles.
What?
It's just flipping roles.
But that's what I mean. Do you think that the very conceit is the downfall?
Yeah, it's nothing unique. It's just changing names and, you know, and characters on an already established pattern.
Right, but have you read comics recently? That's sort of the point.
Well, I understand, but that's what it happens to a lot of people. They get burnt out on them. Because it ends up being a rehash of the same stories every, you know, decade. So I'm just saying, that has nothing to do with the theme that you chose, but...
It doesn't. I think that, you just turned that around and made anything that is now subsequently going to happen all my fault.
Yep.
The actual theme
We're
of
back.
The show was that it's all your fault, just for the record. I mean, we established that when we talked to Sean also.
Good luck with that.
Yeah. All this hatred and it pulls my focus.
No. Mission accomplished.
So I thought that part of what was so appealing about this role reversal, this what if version of the Spider-Man story, was Gwen's, I don't know, like, distance from everything around her in a way that I don't find is as common with Peter, right? He's like, what?
I don't know. I could see that. There's been plenty of arcs where Peter's kind of been that introspective, kind of brooding, you know, especially the earlier stuff. I think this was a homage to that.
To the earlier, the way that he is more brooding, more... Okay.
Yeah, the younger Peter, even though, you know, Peter doesn't age that much, but he's still technically like an adult man now and not the not the teenager
out of
or,
high
you know,
school,
guy.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Where this is more the teenage Peter, but it's Gwen Stacy instead.
But she was also out of high school.
Yeah, but it's... I'm not going to talk to you about Spider-Man continuity.
No,
regardless, the characterization
Aaron,
is fine.
I'm talking about this book right now.
Yes.
Okay, that's all. I'm not interested in talking to you about Spider-Man continuity at all. For the record, will never happen. Done.
Well, looks like I have a new challenge.
Nope. Just this book. Just, like, where she is in her life.
Yeah.
That's all. That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
Out of high school, sure. Young adult, like, has a connection socially that she's not engaged in.
Mm-hmm.
And...
True.
And actually, it's sort of a wonderful little throwback to, like, Peter not being there for... Right? It's Mary Jane's performances. Yes?
Sure.
Yeah?
Yeah. Oh, yes. You mean, like, always being absent?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. And so, like, here's Gwen missing her actual one, too.
Yes, absolutely.
So I appreciated that in this, like, little Spider-Man world that is being what-if created.
It's a perfect one-off issue.
I don't know if I agree. I think that there is something about the formula that will work in some cases and will, like, work extra well in other cases. And this one is an example of the latter. And there's nothing wrong with maybe seeing more of it.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't really feel like I'd need to see more. I enjoyed it a lot. There's a lot of Spider-Man books.
You don't like fun things that are fun.
I like fun things that are fun without making them so much fun all the time that they're no longer fun.
Mm. Okay, fair enough.
Fun in moderation. Funeration.
How you feeling there?
Moder funish. I'll work on it. There is a term there somewhere. So, yeah, I don't know. You know, music is a thing in this. Let's move on.
Really? You don't think it had more to do with, like, creating her character and giving her, like, an outlet and a backdrop for the rest of the way that we get to experience her character? Like, you were that turned off by that exposure to, like, music in her life that you just don't even have an opinion on it.
I'm not turned off by it. I mean, it's fine. She's in a band and she listens to her iPod and she's Spider-Woman. Girl.
Wow. Do you listen to music, like, in your life?
Yeah.
A lot?
Less these days. I mean, it's hard.
Do you have strong opinions about music, Aaron Myers?
No, not really.
You do. We fight about it every week, and that's why I'm surprised that you don't have... I guess I'm surprised that wasn't, like, a touch point for you with this book. I thought it was a major component of her character and one of the reasons why it was so appealing.
Well, the music didn't make her character appealing to me.
To you, right.
Yeah, but it has nothing to do, like, saying I have strong opinions about music in terms of the show is different because you always want to pick terrible stuff and I want people to actually listen to it. So it has nothing to do with because I feel that, like, the music is right. It just has to be right for the show and not horrible.
Okay,
yeah.
Fair enough.
Thank you. I'm doing it for everyone else. And I'm actually doing it for you. I'm saving you from yourself.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
If anything, I'm the hero of this story.
Always. Oh. So back to Gwen's...
Alternate reality or real reality?
Gwen's story.
But that kind of goes back to, like, you know, a what if, and it's a characterization of an established character. Like, I didn't really feel like Gwen Stacy was a rock star, you know, prior to this.
No, I wouldn't have...
So this isn't Gwen Stacy. This is a character called Gwen Stacy, who is not really like the original character Gwen
Stacy.
Sure.
I will definitely allow for that. There were, like, her dad was a cop, so, like, that was the major similarity. She was blonde.
Right. But the rest is a character that's been created.
Yeah. But a very appealing new character that, for me, like, the reason why I was pulled in initially was because of, I don't know, like, the way that the rest of her life was fleshed out. Like, she was much more delightful to me than, like, past versions of Gwen Stacy.
For sure, yeah. That's what I said. It's a great one-off story.
Wow. Okay.
Yep.
We can disagree. That happens occasionally.
I mean, more is fine as long as it's good, but... I'm not desperate for it. I enjoyed it a lot.
Okay, fair enough. And you hate music, and you hate comics, and you hate me. I can't even fight with you. You're just indifferent.
You know, it's the opposite of love and, or whatever, what is it? The opposite of love isn't hate, it's indifference.
Is that a thing?
Yeah, I just said it.
Hmm.
I don't even think I came up with it, but I'll still call it my own. Mm-hmm. You want to talk about another book then that I could take or leave?
Yeah, wow. The actual theme. Not that Aaron is always at fault. It's that, like, Aaron doesn't actually like comics this week.
Another title, if I was going to pick an independent one, I would say I'm really heavy into James Tynion IV's The Woods right now. It has been such a wonderful story, and it just started about 4 months ago, so you should still be able to find it. Pick this one up. A high school is transplanted to another planet. It is so, so wonderful. I can't say enough about it.
Our second book this week is The Wicked and the Divine, number 4, written by Karen Gillan and drawn by Jamie McKelvey. It's colored by Matt Wilson and lettered by Clayton Coles. The Wicked and the Divine is published by Image Comics.
I'm going to read the recap, but I can't wait to get into this with you.
Yeah.
Every 90 years, 12 gods return as young people. They are loved. They are hated. In 2 years, they are all dead. The year is 2014. It's happening now. It's happening again. Lucifer appears to have murdered a judge. She says she didn't do it. Laura has tried to prove it. Got nowhere. Journalist friend Cassandra's best guess? Baal did it. In walks Baal. Shit. Read on with your eyes and your seeing mind. Oh. How do you feel about this book, Aaron Myers?
I like it. It's a great concept.
But?
I have a personal disconnect with it.
Tell me why.
I realized with this issue, I just got taken out of the story by the main character's inner monologue.
Oh.
Like
what we talked about last week.
Sure, but more with the way she speaks and thinks.
Okay.
And I don't know if it's really hard for me to articulate, and it's not something people are going to agree with me mm-hmm. on, and not that I expect them to. It's just an old man Myers problem mm-hmm. that I couldn't help but like just get taken out of the story and have this sort of, I don't know, just this, the thought of, oh, this is like a 40-year-old man trying to write what a 16-year-old girl thinks and sounds like.
And you don't think that that's particularly successful?
I think it is for most people. It just wasn't for me.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
No.
You know, like, well, why not? I don't think people think of it the same way, or it's right, it's spot on, and it's just I'm... You know, I was talking with our mutual friend, Cameron Williams.
Oh, I know him.
One-time guest host of this
yep.
show. And I was telling him that at a certain point the last couple of years, I can still speak the language of the current generation, but I'm translating for myself. It's no longer part of my lexicon.
Okay.
Does that make sense, what I'm saying?
It definitely makes sense.
That I've had to now teach myself how people are communicating, as opposed to it becoming just being part of my, you know, whatever, everyday.
Younger people, though. Not all people.
Correct. Okay. I would say, you know, younger people being the lifeblood of a current internet conversation.
Okay.
So, like, in the case of this book, you know, it's just called the Tumblr generation, in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of, that speaking and that internal thinking didn't ring with me. And maybe it's because I'm just not part of that generation and it feels foreign now. Or I personally just felt like I don't think she would be thinking this way. I think it's amusing to read it that way, but it feels false and it feels like what I do. It felt like the translation from you know, a prior generation to a current generation.
Okay. So do you think that that's inherently bad?
I mean, kind of, because the point of the story is you shouldn't be taken out of it.
But it sounds like you're making an argument about authenticity.
I am, and I think that's very hard to do for writers if they're not... It's hard. It's conditional. Just in this case, it just doesn't feel correct. It doesn't feel right.
I think it's hilarious that you're making that point about a book about gods who are treated like rock stars. And the fake perception of that rock star mentality and kind of being caught up in it. And
mm-hmm.
then a young girl who is essentially going like behind the scenes with these rock stars and seeing how it really is.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing how fake some of that presentation is.
Sure.
And you are making a comment about her commentary on the fakeness.
No, I'm saying the execution of her character rings false.
But it's all an act.
Like I don't. All but of I don't. It. I don't buy her character. It's not though.
Why isn't it?
Because I'm talking
even
about
when you're
her
in that moment, and you are recognizing that this world is constructed, then you're responding in kind.
No, because I'm not talking about her interaction with the characters. I'm talking about her internal monologue.
I am too.
So in particular, her when she's in the Pantheon and she's. And the whole, like, fail, you know, like, I'm full of fail, you know, this is fail, I'm so fail.
You have like, a teenage daughter. Have you not spoken with her? That is how
yes.
they all talk and think and articulate the emotional, like, weight of these very big moments in Tumblr speak.
I agree that they speak that way. They don't think that way.
See, I disagree only because I have been around teenagers in a creative environment where they are, like, actually taking thoughts from their heads and putting them on paper, and thoughts from their heads and putting either words or images to them. And so it's, like, kind of the closest you can get to seeing them translate those thoughts. And it's exactly the same. It's all of that.
Maybe. So that,
internet
so that's what
slang.
I'm saying, though.
That has, and I'm not making a judgment about whether that's good or bad. I'm saying that this, the that world that they are, like, inhabiting is absolutely affecting the way that they are thinking about and processing that world.
You might be right. So that's why I said I don't think anyone's going to agree with me. This is my perception problem. And maybe it's just I don't like the character. Maybe I just hate kids. Like,
oh, right.
I don't like the Tumblr generation.
Right. You hate kids. It's cool.
Yeah, maybe
and
it's
music.
Just annoying then to me then.
And music. Yep. And gods. Do you hate gods too? Because that could be
sure.
awkward.
Uh-huh. So, it's not like it's hard to criticize or just try to parse this stuff out about personal feelings about something and say, like, I'm going to drop the book. Like, I still like reading it. I just, maybe just don't like the character.
Just
and not that she's like distasteful or anything, like it's fine. I just and maybe at some point I'll just be like, I don't care about this kid.
Just anymore. Her or the actual like rock star gods themselves?
No, I really like that aspect of it. I think it's a really compelling story.
Okay.
It's a cool hook. Like that kind of stuff keeps me on. Like if it was just about like her like live journal, which I know kids don't use anymore. That was a joke. Then I just, you know, forget it. I don't care.
Wow.
So that's all. Yeah.
So
it's okay. It's okay for me to think that way, to be like, to not connect to a character or to have such a disconnect from a character, either because of how the creator is writing them or because of just how that character is to where you don't want to read a book. Right.
Yeah. But I feel like that was true with both of the books this week.
No, I liked the Gwen Stacy one.
But you don't want more of it.
No, I still liked it.
And you don't really like this, but you're okay with more of it.
I don't like her. I like the story.
Okay.
I mean, I don't like women. You know, that's really what it comes down to.
Oh, you said it, not me.
Yeah, that's what you were digging for. Mm-hmm. Mm.
Nah, I wasn't going to go that route this week.
Okay,
I was gonna
give
it's
you too
a
easy.
Reprieve.
Thank you. I've been sick.
Oh, how are you feeling?
I'm okay. I'm a little tired.
Good.
Arguing with you really wears me out.
It's a good thing we only do this once a week.
Oh, God. Can't imagine.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, anyway, you could talk about this book if you want.
No, I'm actually really fascinated by your perspective on the way that she's presented. Mostly because I don't agree, but I also think that even if I did agree in part, which I'm going to give it some more thought, and maybe I will... It's not that I don't see your point. I just don't see it as a turnoff. But I guess I don't necessarily think that construction is bad, even if it is inaccurate. Like, this book is a product of right now in this moment. It is a product of appealing to and writing about that generation, much the same way that Young Avengers was. And that is both cool and approachable, but also will make it dated very quickly. Because there are speech patterns and there are conventions that are like absolute direct allusions to things that are said online and methods of communicating online that will that have a very short shelf life.
Mm-hmm.
And
maybe that's part of it too, that if it is not timeless and it's very much tied to a generational moment that I'm not part of.
Okay. But then
that doesn't make it a bad story. It's also just not angled. It's angled for those who would understand that and not have to translate it.
But it's a very universal story. It's just that this translation isn't working for you.
Correct.
Right?
I think more in this issue in particular, and it doesn't, you know, mean I won't continue to read. I'm still interested in what happens in the story. Mm-hmm. And I compare this to, say, Young Avengers, which is the same team, and I didn't feel that way with Young Avengers.
Really? Because I thought it was actually at times even more egregious, because in that case, and again, that doesn't mean that I didn't totally fucking love that book, but that's kind of a combination of the established mythos. Like imagine if this team was doing the Spider-Gwen story. Like, that would probably be your worst nightmare, because then you're messing with this kind of established world, and you're putting this layer of pithy teenage irreverence on it. And that sounds like, for Aaron Myers, a recipe for disaster.
I mean, maybe. It goes by week to week, or maybe it's a matter of critical mass. So, like, maybe Young Avengers didn't bother me. I liked it a lot. And then when it was over, and then we have this book, now I've just hit, like, a wall or something. Mm. Where I'm just like, I'm done with Tumblr speak.
Got it.
Look, just get off my lawn and stay out of my backyard. But I see, I'm not quite old enough for grandpa speak
yet. You're not.
I'm just in this, I'm like in this no man's land. I just don't know where I belong anymore.
It's because you don't like fun things that are fun. I've been telling you that for like a month now.
My parents are coming up in a couple weeks, though, and they are bringing up all my tapes.
You mean like cassette tapes?
Yeah.
VHS tapes? What kind of tapes?
Both, yes.
What are you going to do with that?
I'm just going to sit in my room with my boombox.
Do you have something that will play those things?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Like, I finally got rid of my VHS tapes because I had not had a VCR in 10 years. So it seemed stupid to continue to move them from house to house with no method of watching them.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
But you still have one?
I even started buying VHS tapes again.
Of course you did.
Yeah, well, these kids these days, with their high definition.
You don't like anything good.
I like everything good, but everything good has already happened.
Right on.
Mm-hmm.
So thanks for not letting me talk about any of the stuff that I wanted to talk about, by the way.
You're welcome.
Because you're grumpy and you're sick and because you didn't do your homework, it's fine.
I did plenty of homework. I just had things to say, and Old Man Myers is going to say him.
Wow.
Go post that to your Tumblogs.
I don't even have a Tumblr, and you do. So let the record state that...
Go write your slash fiction.
That means something very different.
Go do your shipping stories about comics therapy. I know the terms. I just think it's dumb.
I'm going to stop that one right there.
It's all dumb.
Yeah. Anything else?
Everyone's dumb, except for me. I'm going to go watch Big Trouble in Little China on beta.
Awesome.
On my 13-inch Zenith.
13-inch little television with the built-in VCR at the bottom?
No, we didn't have anything like that. Come on. Nope, we didn't have that kind of money. We had to rent a VCR, and we'd rent a VCR on my birthday so we could watch. One year we rented Neverending Story, VCR and tape. And the next year, I think it was Masters of the Universe.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. These kids, the kids these days with their BitTorrents and their YouTubes, like, they don't know.
Hmm.
Yep.
Every week, I feel like instead of us getting closer, Aaron, we are getting further and further apart.
Well, I'll be driving to Portland and you're driving to Tahoe. So that even puts us further apart.
Fair enough.
And then you'll be going to New York soon, too.
I am. Can't wait.
Me too. That'll put you like 3,500 miles away. It's great. Well, until then. You want to talk to Sean Williams?
Let's talk to Sean Williams. It's
all right.
Probably better than talking to each other.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And finally, I'm supposed to make a recommendation or give a shout out. I'm going to give my shout out to comicsbulletin.com because I think those guys do an amazing job covering comics history, old creators, old ideas, books that have slipped through the crevices, really. And it, like, if it wasn't for the interview I just read about Killraven recently, I wouldn't be actively seeking these Killraven stories to read. Never thought I would even say something like that out loud. So, Comics Bulletin. Check them out, man. Great stuff.
This week on The Couch, we welcome writer Sean E. Williams. Sean is the co-writer of Artful Daggers, published digitally by Monkey Brain Comics and in trade by IDW. He wrote the New York Times bestselling Ferrest, Return of the Maharaja, published by Vertigo, and has written for The Vampire Diaries and upcoming Sensation Comics, published by DC. Thanks for chatting with us today, Sean, and thank you for being accommodating with your schedule. Everything was 100% Aaron's fault.
This is no problem. Thanks for having me.
And it's always my fault.
It is, but I still have to say it just in case there's a new listener tuning in or Sean's like, gosh, Andrea sucks. No, Aaron sucks. Andrea is awesome.
Why can't it be equal?
Because it doesn't work like that. 100% your fault.
That's true. Men do get more of the responsibility than women. Anyway, let's start with a general State of the Union kind of update. Artful Daggers, Sensation Comics, what do you have coming up and what else are you working on heading into 2015?
Yeah, Sensation Comics, I was just tweeting this morning. Like right now it's Thursday the 18th. So yeah, next week our issue of Sensation Comics comes out. It's number 7.
Oh, awesome.
So yeah, September 25th, it's titled Bullets and Bracelets. So, and I don't think it's what a lot of people are expecting, which is fun.
And just to clarify, that's the digital release number 7. So
yes,
print will be a couple months from now.
Yeah. It's print number 3 and I think it's slated for the October slot. Okay.
Yep.
So
I think it's important for these, like the Sensation and Adventures of Superman, like, that people realize, because some people only buy print and some people only read the digital, and those kind of, I think, confuse people on the numbering sometimes.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, we have the same problem with Artful Daggers too, where, you know, we're in issue 14 for Artful just came out last week. You know, in the being just trades, you know, it's, you know,
mm-hmm.
the digital issues collected and all that stuff. So, but yeah, with the digital to print floppies, it's a little more wiggly. It's not like they can do like issue 3.1, 3.2, and 3.3. Or
right.
I guess they could, but then, you know, that's a whole other set of problems.
Sure.
So what's next? What about the rest of this year and then looking ahead?
Oh yeah. So Sensation Comics comes out next week. We've got Artful Daggers ongoing. Adam and I just wrapped the script for the last issue of the arc, which is issue number 17. After taking a couple weeks off, kind of straddling like Rose City and New York Comic Con, we're going to dive into the third arc for that. So that's exciting. I've got a couple, a bunch of projects out in the hopper right now that we're waiting to hear back on. I've got a creator-owned series that has a publisher set up, that we just started getting art for, so that's exciting. And we're going to be sending
anything specific
it...
you can give us on that, or just keep.
No, of course not.
Oh, right.
You know, not until the marketing department says go. You know.
Got it.
The usual, you know, bunch of stuff going on. Nothing I can talk about. I've got a prose proposal that we're wrapping up. That should be going out to the publisher next week. So that's exciting.
When you say we, do you mean like it was co-written or just you and...
This one actually is co-written. So, yeah, which was a lot of fun. You know, co-writing is one of those things that if it's the right project, I enjoy doing it. You know, but for the most part, I don't really consider myself like a co-writer. Mm-hmm. It just happens that, yeah, like this book kind of came about. Actually, I have two books with the same co-writer. One we already finished, and then this other one's for a proposal. That would be our second book together. And then Artful obviously is co-written, and then one of the pitches I'm sending out right now is co-written. But yeah, I mean, it's a fun thing for me. I like having, you know, not all the pressure coming up, all the ideas and all that stuff. It's, sure. You know, but that's comics in general, you know, just having collaborators, means that, you know, everything is just improved just because the better ideas is the one that rises to the top.
Yeah. That's why I was surprised when you mentioned that it was prose. Cause that's, it certainly happens, but it's obviously less common.
Yeah. And, it's not something, I would have even thought about really, except that my co-writer has co-written stuff in the past, so it's like, oh, you know, they're amenable to it. So, you know, maybe we should work together. I think once it's announced, it'll be a lot more obvious as to why and how and everything else. But until then, yeah, it was just it just kind of came about very organically, kind of like Artful. But yeah, like, I mean, all my DC stuff is also, you know, which is all also has its own benefits.
So. Who, remind me who your artist is on Sensation?
Marguerite Sauvage.
Right.
She's French Canadian, I believe. although I know she spent some time living in Paris. So I don't know if she's French living in Canada or French Canadian who's been to France, or you guys will have to have her on to find out.
Got it.
Yeah. But so, yeah, her art is just phenomenal. Like it melted my brain as soon as I saw it.
That's good.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't sound good for you, but I know what you mean.
No, having a melted brain is not always a good thing. Right. But yeah, our editor, Christy Quinn, she, when I pitched the story idea and it got approved, she's like, I have this artist in mind. You know, here's a sample. She's not what you would typically think of, but I think she'll be perfect for this project. So I went and looked, and because Marguerite's more of a commercial artist, her background's more commercial stuff. And she did a cover for Hinterkind, the Vertigo book. Mm-hmm. And just seeing that, it's like, okay, like I can kind of see like where Christy's brain was, but then as soon as saw the actual pages, it's just like, man, it's just phenomenal. Like it's the type of stuff where it's better than you kind of can hope for. And that's where having a great editor just makes all the difference in the world, where you can just put your total trust in them that, you know, they're doing, they know what they're talking about and they're doing the right thing for the project, which obviously every editor, you know, wants and, you know, so.
Yeah, but it's nice to get that like vote of confidence that it does actually, like, the stars align sometimes. So
yeah, absolutely. And like, I just got picked up for a couple issues for another project at another publisher, day before yesterday, in fact. And it was the same thing where we were talking artists, and you know, they made this one suggestion, send some sample art over. It's like, oh yeah, obviously it's a no brainer. So. it's nice to not have to be, you know, behind the wheel on these projects, you know, like with creator owned books, how, you know, you are.
Right.
Is it sometimes hard when you're so used to the creator owned stuff to give up that kind of control to like get that pair up, or is it sort of a nice relief of not having to worry about that? Or is it both?
It's a little bit of both. It depends on the project. Like with Ferrist, you know, we were already doing Artful Daggers at that point by the time I started, scripting the Ferrist the Ferris scripts. Like, I was already on board. I was on board for 3 years, I think, before my first issue came out. It was either 3 or 4 years.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. And that was the type of thing where, you know, coming with Artful being the only, like, produced comic stuff that I had going, I was very much used to being in the driver's seat. And so coming into Ferris, where it's very much you're a cog in the wheel, that was, you know, that was a good mental check for me. That and I knew that going in, which was nice. Like, if I had come in blind and just, like, not known that, I think it would have been a disaster. But knowing, okay, I'm a cog in the wheel, you know, which battles to fight, which ones not to, you know, that was, it was definitely a different experience. But at the same time, it was nice to not have to worry about schedule and stuff. But at the same time, you know, there's always those times where you don't know what's going on and you don't know when your next deadline is going to be. Especially with us working so far out. So it was kind of like, hey guys, I'm trying to plan, you know, where are things currently, what's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
So, but again, being the cog in the wheel, I understood that, you know, my needing to know was not necessarily their priority by a long shot. So, but no, it was a great experience. And, you know, Shelley and Greg are both great editors, and, you know, the stuff that Steve and Phil did art-wise, and Andrew Dollhouse. And I mean, the fact that Todd Klein came up with an entire typeface, you know, for our arc was just phenomenal. Like, it was one of those, like, bucket lists, like, you know, hey, in my wildest dreams, you know, could Todd do a typeface for this arc? And, you know, he did it with such awesome finesse. It was great.
Awesome. I'm a little embarrassed to ask this next question just because I totally don't know the answer and I feel like I should.
Okay.
But, like, let's step back because we've hung out. I've actually interviewed you before. I think ultimately I'm just sort of apologizing for being a jerk. I don't know your origin story. Like, I know you have a background in theater and film. So from a broader standpoint, can you talk about, like, the importance of storytelling in your life, like growing up, how it influenced the path that you took to then be a teller of stories yourself?
Whoa. All right. How long do we have?
Just the highlights, Sean.
All right. So highlights, I guess it would go back to elementary school probably. We could dial it back further than that and, like, talk about, you know, role playing, you know, in kindergarten and that kind of thing. But, I think for me, like, we had one of my cousins come and live with us, when I was in elementary school, and she was in high school and we were in elementary school. So it was like a whole other world was opened up to us. you know, just like culturally and just like, you know, what to expect from life, which, you know, thinking back, I don't know that everyone kind of has that opportunity, which I think really, I don't know, it definitely changed the direction that I think I was going, because she was big into theater, and so she did a bunch of theater stuff, which I don't think I would have ever thought to do theater, you know, if I hadn't grown up with that.
Wow, that's kind of awesome.
Yeah.
Specifically point to, like, the person in your family who pushed you in that direction.
Yeah. And it wasn't even like she was like, well, no, that's not true. She was pushing us because she would make us, like, act in, you know, videos for her, and, like, music videos and stuff. And honestly, like, I consider myself part of Generation X, even though I was, you know, a little on the too young side for that. Just because I grew up with all those Generation X influences that she was experiencing in high school while we were in elementary school. So, so we were in, you know, we would shoot, you know, Madonna music videos and Michael Jackson, you know, music videos and stuff like that, you know, around the house and stuff. So, so that kind of got me into theater, which organically led to film. In high school, I got more into film when we had, you know, editing rigs in the journalism room, and and that kind of thing. And we had a couple like filmmaking like segments in like English classes and that kind of thing. And so, yeah, so in high school, you know, I kind of phased out doing the theater stuff. I directed and wrote theater stuff. Growing up in Montana, I was actually really, I don't know, I hate using the word blessed just because I don't think of it in the religious sense, but just like, you know, just like fortunate to be living in a city that had such a vibrant theater community, especially considering, you know, that was what I wanted to do, you know, coming out of elementary school. And then we moved to Montana in middle school. So yeah, to be able to continue to do theater and not only, you know, to continue to do it, but to have a more vibrant theater experience than I would have otherwise. And this is a long-winded answer, so I apologize. Was again, you know, just really fortunate. So yeah, then that got into film and went to film school at USC in production. So I did a bunch of filmmaking there, you know, when I went in, I wanted to be like a director primarily. And then over the course of it, came out wanting to be a writer producer, and not in television. Cause at the time, you know, in the early 2000s, TV really sucked. So, nobody wanted to do television.
Except for the West Wing.
Except for the West Wing, exactly. And that was, I think Aaron Sorkin like left while I was there.
Yep.
And so even that, like, and I actually worked on an episode of the West Wing. So that was kind of cool in hindsight, even though I didn't watch it. and it was episode 100 too. So we, you know, I was wrangling people at the Huntington Library, which was great.
Nice.
So that was fantastic. Missed an accounting midterm because of it and almost failed out, but you know, it was
right
worth
choice.
It. Yes, I definitely did. So yeah, film, television wasn't really on the table. You know, did the whole producing thing there. And then my wife got into grad school in San Diego. And so basically, it took pretty much everything off of the table aside from writing. So I worked at the coffee shop, at night and wrote during the day and, kind of treated it as my, you know, grad school for writing. I drive up to LA for meetings, you know, fairly regularly, cause it's only a 2-hour drive if San Diego Comic-Con's not going on. just kind of, you know, managed to keep that, you know, a foot in that side of the industry and everything. And then we moved back, after she graduated and after we got married, cause she got a job up there and, you know, kept writing and producing and then kind of organically, started getting into comics and prose. You know, I was getting, after doing it for a decade, I was getting fed up with making stuff, but then having no one see it, which I know is really common among screenwriters, kind of feel that way. So I was getting fed up with that. And it's like, well, I can do prose on my own, and actually get it out there. So kind of what happened, to nudge that along was that I was producing an animated series, that was based on a trading card game. And while I was doing this and chopping it around, a prose publisher, or actually just a publisher period, approached the card company and said, "Hey, are the rights available for books and comics? Cause we want to make it." And so, the card company came to me and they're like, "Hey, is this okay if we do this at the same time?" I'm like, "Sure, why not? And by the way, you know, if you want to tell them I'd be interested in writing something for them, you know, I'd be happy to." So we got in touch and, I wrote a 6-issue, arc for a comic for them. And that was kind of my training wheels for writing comics. Cause I hadn't before then. And writing screenplays and writing comics are very, very, very different things. Like the format can be kind of similar, but other than that, like they're totally different animals. You know, aside from the amount of white space on the page, they're just totally different. So that was my training wheels for comics. And then to kind of finance the comics, they wanted to do a series of prose novellas. And so I said, hey, well, I'll do that too. Why not? So that was
me becoming the leading expert on the world of this particular trading card game.
Are you at liberty to say what it was?
Yeah, I mean, because it's published. But it's the Wars trading card game by Decipher. Hmm. So there's a series of novellas that were put out. I wrote two of them. I don't think the second one's going to see the light of day. But the first one's out and published. And that was me kind of, you know, cutting my teeth on writing prose. So having both those under my belt, it's like, okay, I can do this. And then one of the TV execs we were working with, on a couple different projects, he was also working at, Arkea at the time. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, hey, you know, well, you know, if you guys got comic stuff, so things kind of organically moved towards comics and prose. And then my wife got a job, here in Minnesota. So we, packed it up and moved up here, and Ferris was happening right around the same time. And so, yeah, it's just been, you know, all in on comics and prose, basically.
Partially though, as a product of moving away from what would have been other options though, right? I mean,
oh yeah, absolutely. Like, okay. You can't live away from LA and do screenwriting, or TV writing, especially, and have it really work. Like, it's just, it's, you know, you have to be in too many meetings, you know, too frequently. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are ways to make it work, but it's just, for me, not like, after doing it for a decade, it was not worth the time and energy anymore. And, you know, frankly, I just needed a break. I was burned out. So, you know, after, I think it was after like being up here for like 2 years that, I was really finally like, okay, I could start thinking about screenplays again.
Mm. You needed a detox from it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's just a very abusive relationship, you know, Hollywood and writing. Cause yeah, you just, you know, it's an exercise in rejection, which, you know, you get used to, but at the same time, like at a certain point, you just want to have something made, like I said. So. Mm.
So does that make comics easier? Because you hear similar stories from people trying to break into the comics industry too.
Comics, no, I mean, comics are just as hard, as far as the pitching and the rejection goes, you know, because there's only five or six places in town that you can take stuff, mm-hmm. To get stuff published. So that's, you know, that's that same level of rejection, because they only have so many slots that they can, you know, do comics for each month, you know, I mean, and, right. You know, talking to the publishers, like all these editors are maxed out, you know, they're doing, you know, more than 4 comics a month. And it's just like, they don't have time to breathe. You know, I feel bad for them.
I mean, in a way it's kind of nice. It means that the industry is thriving with creative talent.
Oh yeah, for sure. It just means that, you know, there aren't, as many slots as you would want for your own comics as a writer.
Sure.
You know, so there's that element. There's the whole, you know, dynamic of artists only being able to do 1 series a month, compared to writers being able to do, you know, 4, I think, comfortably is what, you know, where I'm at. So finding an artist can be difficult at times, you know, if you stick with it, I think there's enough other venues now that, you know, you can make your own comics and get it out there and find an audience. But it's not the traditional routes that people have come to expect, kind of.
Mm. Well, let's talk about comics for a second. Let's talk about Sensation Comics.
Okay.
It kind of seems like a dream project for a lot of creators. Mm-hmm. You know, has some of the same flexibility that Adventures of Superman had. Was it Wonder Woman specifically as a character that appealed to you, or kind of playing more with the DC universe, or just being able to do it? You know, it seems like it'd just be a fun opportunity regardless, but I'm kind of curious if there was something specific about Wonder Woman.
Yes. So with Sensation Comics, Well, let's back up a little bit. Like, for me, as a writer, as a comic book writer, I kind of always shied away from going after any type of superhero books. Like, even before Ferris, it was like, superheroes. Like, I grew up not reading superhero comics, mostly because I was intimidated by the all the continuity and, you know, and backstories that all these characters had. It's like, I'm not going to jump into the middle of some story that I know nothing about. And our local comic shop was one of those, like, musty smelling comic shops, which, you know, I've, you know, since come to love as, like, a nostalgia thing. But, like, at the time, it was just, like, sweaty and gross. And it was like, you know, I'd go there for my trading cards. I wouldn't go there for comics. You know, Death of Superman happened. You know, that was a big, like, significant, like, oh, I'm aware of superhero comics moment for me. But, like, other than that, like, I grew up reading Adventures of Tintin, you know, any of the Disney ones. So superheroes were never really on my plate. So then once writing comics became an option, I was kind of like, well, you know, I'm not really a viable writer for any of those because I don't know any of the mythology of any of these characters, so I'm just not even going to pursue it.
But, Sean, is that something that you're sort of putting on yourself, or is there actually, like, a perception or expectation within the industry or within the editor community within the industry that is something that you have to have?
I think it's a little bit of both. Like, it was definitely a conscious thing for me of, like, shying away from it. But at the same time, I think, you know, now that I, you know, am in comics and have been in comics and paying attention full time, I definitely think there is that exclusionary element to, you know, to people both, you know, from the reader side and then also from not necessarily the publisher side, but just like the, I don't know, the industry as a whole as far as superheroes go. So with the new 52, it's like, oh, well, maybe I have a shot, you know, to jump in at this point. You know, cause if they're rebooting everything, then everyone's on the same page, you know, and all this stuff, but then that never really panned out. Mostly because, Vertigo and DC kind of operate as separate entities. So there was never any crossover for me aside from, you know, like a party, you know, like the DC, like New York Comic Con party where it was like, you know, hey, this is, you know, so-and-so and, you know, not even catching their name because it was so loud or whatever. So there's never really that opportunity for crossover for me, and I don't remember exactly how it happened, but yeah, I got, connected to Christy Quinn, the Sensation Comics editor, when she was doing Vampire Diaries. And I think that kind of came about with my film and TV background. You know, another editor over there, you know, thought of me and, was like, hey, you know, you should talk to Christy. And so, so I did a couple issues of Vampire Diaries. And then, while I was at a convention earlier this year, another editor's like, oh, you know, this thing might be happening. You might want to reach out to Christy about it. Maybe, possibly. And so not knowing anything about, you know, I mean, I knew it was Sensation Comics. I knew it was Wonder Woman. But like not knowing anything about her really, aside from, you know, the Linda Carter TV series kind of stuff. I was kind of like, all right, well, I gotta do some research and figure something out. And so basically I, you know, leaned into my ignorance and it's like, okay, not knowing anything about Wonder Woman, what can I bring to the table?
That's sort of what I was going with earlier, is that, like, we've heard that, or we've heard inklings of the fact that there is a perspective that you can bring to the table. So I'm, like, super intrigued to hear that, like, journey for you.
Totally. Well, and, like, for me as a writer, I've always found strength in being able to mine pre-existing properties. So like with Wars, you know, they had all these trading cards, you know, hinted at, you know, a larger universe, you know, on the lore on each card. And then, Decipher actually, commissioned, Michael Stackpole and a bunch of other sci-fi writers to kind of flesh out the universe in a bunch of short stories. So I'd go through and read those and, you know, pick all these little pieces and then put them together into, like, you know, something new and something that I could call my own. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with Ferris. When I initially pitched that to Bill, you know, I think I had reread all of Fables for the second time and kind of like pieced together these little things that are like, oh, well, this never played out. And, you know, they hint at this, but this never went anywhere.
It's prepping for a job interview for a
kind of,
you know, it's a very established property with a lot of mythology to it.
Yeah. And like with,
that's actually kind of awesome. Like just,
thanks.
I mean, you're giving us a specific example, but, you're sort of describing everyone's sort of, like dream scenario, like pick a property that you really enjoy and read it a bunch of times and then just share some ideas about things that you'd like to see it do.
It's kind of like the ultimate fan fiction, you know?
It is.
Like, yeah.
You said it, not me, but that's exactly kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah. Well,
that's awesome.
Well, and the problem is like, you know, I've had this, but when you think about it, Fables in its own way is its own kind of fan fiction because,
exactly.
You know, it's all drawing from those sources too. But I think fan fiction is, it's hard because like, it's got, it's like the word has its own stigma now of like, you know, unlicensed ripoff kind of thing. And it's like, well, no, but you know, and again, you can't bring anything up on the internet without pissing everyone off. So, But like, so like with Fables, it was the same thing where like, you know, I went through and read and pieced together the story about Bluebeard and pitched it to Bill and he liked it. And, you know, Ferris was kind of in its infancy, like Lauren Bucus was already on board and Chris Roberson had already done a couple of arcs of Cinderella. So, so he's like, here, well, why don't we roll this Bluebeard story over into Ferris, because, you know, in Bluebeard's mind, he's the fairest fable out there. So it totally works. And then Bill approached me later about doing a Charming arc too. And then he and Vertigo were kind of like, well, why don't we do Charming first? Because he's a little bit more of a name brand character than Bluebeard. So that happened. And that's that. But then, yeah, Vampire Diaries was the same way. I went back and watched the TV show and was like, oh, well, they hint at this incident and they, you know, never really expounded on it. And, oh, here's the name of a character on a tombstone. I bet I could do something with that. So Sensation was the same way.
You have the best job ever, Sean.
I kind of love it. And I actually, there's a DC thing I want to do so badly, but it's the same type of thing. And I don't know if they would ever let me do it. But I'm going to keep trying. So Sensation. Basically I did the same thing. I'm not knowing anything about Wonder Woman. It's like, okay, let's go back to the beginning. You know, what is her origin story? So I went back and read all the original Sensation comics and the stuff before Sensation and, you know, kind of picked up this kernel of a story that was kind of a throwaway thing in Sensation Comics number one. Mm-hmm. And said, all right, well, let's explore this a little bit more, or at least as much as we can in 10 pages. So instead of one or two pages, you know, we got 10 to play with. So,
well, before we forget about it. So what's the DC pitch that you'd love to do?
Oh, I'm not going to put it on here because
you're just going to tease it. So I have to write my own fan fiction about it.
Grant Morrison will steal it. And, start an empire off of it.
That's true. That guy's always ripping off people's ideas.
I know, right?
You gotta watch out for Morrison. That's what they always say.
Yeah. So, So, I mean, that's kind of, you know, where I came at Sensation. And, you know, I think people will be surprised. I hope they like it. We'll see. I don't know. Next week.
Dun, dun, dun.
I know. I've stopped reading reviews, so I actually won't know what they think. But
how long did it take you to stop reading reviews?
I think the trade paperback for Ferris was kind of the nail in the coffin.
Okay.
Just because there's a lot of Fables readers who wait until the trade paperback. Mm-hmm. So until then, it was like, you know, comics reviewers who come at things a little bit more academically than general readers. But then as soon as people, you know, the most common criticism I've gotten about the arc was that Prince Charming is the main character, and this is supposed to be a series about girls. And, you know, the fact that, you know, that's the level of criticism, you know, that we're kind of getting, it's like, all right, I don't need to read this anymore. Because mm-hmm. every one of those would, you know, outshine, you know, 10 positive reviews. I mean, we got an amazing review from Comixosity, and like, you know, one, you know, reader saying, I didn't like it. It's like, oh man, ruined my day.
Does that affect your, did you find when you were reading the reviews and even in the past, does that affect the creative process? Would that like haunt you? Or like when you're writing something, would that, you kind of think like, ah, what was somebody going to say about this?
Absolutely. I'm not gonna lie. Mm. In fact, like once it came our turn to do our Arc of Ferris, I kind of had one of those like, oh God, what have I gotten myself into kind of moments. But the nice thing is that like both Bill, I had a couple people, Bill was one of them, tell me that no matter what you do, someone's going to not like it and someone's going to hate it. So don't worry about it. So it was nice to hear from Bill, but then also, in doing my arc, you know, I pulled this character Nalayani, from the Mahabharata. And so wanting to do, you know, Hinduism properly, I reached out to, the Dean of Religion at USC, who is himself a practicing Hindu. You know, just kind of, you know, floated ideas by him and, you know, just kind of feel like what I could do. And I mean, I was basically like the touchstone for our arc as far as like authenticity and all that stuff. So like all the, you know, tracking the Talak and all that stuff, it was on me. That was actually a point of realizing that I was a cog in the wheel in the first issue, because there was one page where she was drawn without the Talak when she needed it. And so like I had to like keep going back to Greg and Shelley and being like, guys, she really needs this. Can we fix this in inking? And then like it didn't get fixed then. It's like, guys, we really need this. Can we fix it in, you know, coloring? And, you know, it got fixed, but it was also just like, you know, squeaky wheel kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. But yeah, so talking to him too, you know, the Dean, you know, he was telling me, you know, well, you know, this is all great, you know, you're gonna do a good job. But you know, no matter what you do, just know that, you know, some ultra conservative, you know, Hindu is going to be offended that you're using a character from Hinduism, you know, in a comic book, about fables. And so it's like between him and Bill both, you know, kind of saying, hey, not everyone's going to like it. It's like, all right, I can deal with that.
And that seems like a concession you just have to make as a creator, that nothing you make will.
Yeah. And I mean, that's part of my problem is like, I'm a real people pleaser. And so when someone doesn't like me, I like want to know why and I want to fix it. Mm-hmm. So to have, you know, faceless, you know, Joe Schmo 58 on Amazon be like, "Mer, I didn't like this." It's like, how can I change this? How can I make this better for you?
I think that's a losing proposition.
Do you engage with that? Or did you used to have those kinds of conversations? I think you sort of can now access like whatever Joe Schmo 58 and like Twitter obviously is a bad place for that, but it happens all the time.
Yeah.
Well, I've never seen you do that. So I'm curious if you have.
I haven't really had anyone like reach out to me. So it's been like, you know, this whole, and I don't know if it's just Fables readers, you know, who are more literary types. And so it's more just like, and now I read something and then I post something about it and that's it. And it's less engaging than superhero stuff. So I'm kind of like both excited and scared about Sensation coming out, because all of a sudden I'm going to be on the superhero radar where people are a lot more vocal and in your face about stuff. So we'll see. I don't know. Because I haven't experienced that. Like,
You have to, I don't know, get get prepped to fight or not.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's one of those things where, you know, everyone has their own opinion and, you know, everyone has their own history with all these characters. And, you know, I've been in the comics industry enough and seen enough of this stuff go down that I kind of know what to expect. So I'm prepared in that sense. It's not like I'm just coming into a blind being like, hey, comics, you know, what's this over here?
Because unfortunately you've probably seen it firsthand how,
yeah,
like people
friends.
Are kind of terrible.
Yeah. Friends getting totally assaulted
right.
online by this stuff.
Right.
Yeah. So I'm prepared for it if it comes. If it doesn't, then that means I did my job better than I expected, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah,
or worse than I expected if it's not worth, you know, engaging me about.
Oh, no.
I think there's an endless amount of energy to destroy somebody else's
yeah.
hard work.
Yeah, that's true. And there's a lot more of that out there than there is, you know, creative on our end, you know.
Totally.
Yes.
They outnumber us, basically.
Well, I have a con question for you.
Okay.
Maybe because it's still con season, but it feels like it always is.
Yeah.
But you do tend to go to a lot of Comic Cons. Like, you've made that a priority for you as a creator. So as a writer, what do you get out of that? And what do you sort of look to make sure that your experience at these various cons is a good one, like both personally but also professionally?
It's funny you should ask that, because I actually wrote a column in an upcoming book about making comics that I don't think has been announced yet, so I can't talk about it. But it was this exact same question, basically. For this past year, I went to at least one convention a month, kind of promoting and exhibiting with Artful Daggers.
Mm-hmm.
Because being a creator-owned book, and with Adam and me and Andrew not being Grant Morrison, you know, we're not on anyone's radar. When the book first came out, I called like the top 200 retailers here in the States just to be like, "Hey, I'm writing Ferris. You know, it's the middle of the arc right now, and I have a creator-owned book coming out." And if I hadn't done that, then you know, we're just another, you know, one title out of, you know, however many thousand come out each month.
That's that's pretty amazing. I know a couple people who have said like they will write handwritten letters to retailers, or I think that you're the first person I've heard of calling, actually. And that probably affects sales. I'm assuming you probably saw a lot more orders then.
Yeah, well, and a lot of the retailers were really appreciative of it, for that exact reason. Like, you know, they get this, you know, phone book of a catalog every month, and they're expected to wade through it and know, you know, what their customers want. And then also, you know, what they, you know, sight unseen, you know, if a book is going to sell well or not.
Hmm.
I mean, the direct market is a very, very broken system. And, you know, coming in as a not comics person, you know, I can say that, you know, whereas I think people who are used to it, you know, it's kind of, you know, it being the only option, I think it's kind of like, well, this is all we have, which I understand, but it's a very broken system. And like with Artful, I got set up as a retailer, account, so I could, you know, buy all these books to sell at conventions.
Oh.
And seeing the retailer side of it, it's a nightmare. Like, it's a miracle that the comics industry like continues to exist under these like conditions. Like it's literally a miracle.
Oh,
it's
man.
You have no idea. Like I could tell stories. But it's the system we have, and until something major changes, it's what we're stuck with. You know, and I get that it came from a need in the industry. You know, when the industry was struggling and this was the only solution, you know, I just know now that, you know, there's got to be a better way. But it's, you know, it's the whole problem with The Wire. Like, you know, it's, you know, these institutions just get, you know, they're rolling, and getting anything changed in them, it just doesn't happen. Mm. So what were we talking about?
Well, I was just asking, I kind of have that imagining of calling retailers. Like, it's not kind of I don't know what the words I'm looking for. It does put pressure on the retailer, but to have that personal experience with the creator, it's gotta make them feel, okay, well, I'm going to order this because this person took the time to tell me about their book.
And I got a lot of feedback like that, where it's like, you know, A, thanks for letting us know about the book, because there's so many that we couldn't have known about it otherwise. Mm-hmm. But then there's also the fact that we were as invested as creators, letting them know. It's like, okay, well, if these guys take, you know, care enough to, you know, take a couple of days to call all of us, then, you know, they care about the book, you know, hopefully this much as well. And then there were a few retailers who wanted, you know, nothing to do with me. Even though it was, you know, Thursday afternoon and the store was dead. And then there were a couple really, really bad ones. But for the most part, you know, everyone was really cordial and appreciative, and said that they would, you know, increase their order, you know, because of the call. And then there were a handful of retailers that I was on the phone with for a half hour just talking about the industry and, you know, where things are at and, you know, how they see things and how things are going.
I guess that's got to help you, too, as an independent creator, know the different markets, because it seems to me that different areas have very different sort of, it must be cultural. It's just something like you'll just find these trends in different parts of the country for comics, and how you market your book to those specific areas probably makes a big difference too.
Yeah. And there are definitely some stores that's like, no, our readers only buy superhero stuff. Goodbye.
Yeah.
You know, which I also get, but, you know, with stores being, you know, the only way that readers really know about stuff, mm-hmm. It's kind of on them to lead the charge. So
for sure, anyone who says our readers only read superhero stuff, is that's really them saying I only read superhero stuff, so that's all mm-hmm. I get from my readers.
Exactly. Yeah. And one thing moving to Minnesota taught me, which I don't think it could have been a better thing for me, as far as getting into comics, like right around the same time. Because in LA, you know, there's 7 to 12 amazing comic book stores that are all, you know, 10 minutes apart, mm-hmm. and they're just phenomenal. And then moving to Minnesota, my closest comic book shop is an hour and a half away. Mm-hmm. And so it really opened my eyes up to how, you know, the flyover states, as, you know, everything that's not New York and LA, you know, is known in Hollywood, you know, how the rest of the country lives. And so for me, right around that same time, you know, the whole like digital comics debate was going on. And it's like, when your closest comic shop is an hour and a half away, like digital comics are like the only way to grow the industry. Mm-hmm. So for everyone to be pushing back against it, it's like, no, digital can only be a good thing.
Yeah.
Especially when like so many shops are, or not so many, when there are as many, you know, creepy, gross, smelly shops, you know, out there as there are.
Still,
so,
right.
Yeah.
I found some great comic books at creepy, gross, smelly shops. There's a place for them.
Yeah, no, there absolutely is. But, you know, not, you know, we're not going to get, you know, a bunch of kids reading comics through those stores, unfortunately.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Well, I think to go back to cons, I want to touch back on that.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, we totally like dropped that.
Because I assume it's somewhat similar with what you want to get out of a con. You've got the professional connections you can make, but then it's also a matter of making that personal connection with the fans.
Yeah, there's definitely, you know, there's the sales side, like with Artful Daggers. Like, the only way we're going to move the book is to get it out there in front of people, which is great. As a writer, like, for me, most of the shows that I went to this year weren't beneficial as a writer, just because, you know, the writer benefit to going to a con is to make the connections with editors and artists. You know, being stuck behind a table, I wasn't able to make those connections with any of the artists at any of the shows. Like at the Denver show, I had friends there that I didn't even see the whole time because I was at the table. So that was hard. And a lot of those smaller shows too, you know, the editors don't go to, so there's no benefit on the publisher front either.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Which is where, wow, like, you know, Emerald City and San Diego and New York and C2E2 are so, like, crucial, mm-hmm, to developing a career, just because, like, those are the shows that the publishers send the editors to. So right, you can actually, like, you know, get that face time and make those personal connections that lead to work down the line.
Yeah. I hadn't thought about that. I mean, of course, that's, like, that's your sort of secondary motive for being there, is that personal networking.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, wow.
So,
like, I'm sure that sounds like I just came upon this obvious realization, but
obviously
not every company is going to send an editor to, or, you know, whomever, to all of the smaller shows.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a lot of the smaller shows too don't even have a publisher presence, like, as an exhibitor.
Sure.
Which is also frustrating for me, because it's like, I just, you know, I want to see the industry grow, and, mm-hmm, you know, the publishers only have a certain amount of budget for exhibiting. But yeah, when they don't have a booth at a certain show, you know, people talk, and it's like, oh, well, so-and-so not care about us as readers.
Well, like, Marvel hasn't been at Emerald City for the past couple of years, or maybe they were this year, but they weren't there last year. And I remember having a conversation that, like, that was a weird thing, that they didn't, as a publisher, didn't have an official booth.
Yeah.
And so that conversation is absolutely happening. I don't think, I love Emerald City, and I don't think there's any danger of that particular show not being fucking ginormous and awesome. But you're right. It is something that even from the reader side, like, people pay attention to.
Yeah. And again, I understand where the publishers are coming from, because they only have so much money to spend each year on exhibiting, because exhibiting isn't cheap, because, you know, you have the booth, and then you have all the product, and then you have, you know, putting up the staff for it, and, you know, paying them hourly, you know, and all that stuff. Like, it all adds up. It's expensive. But at the same time, you know, we're not growing as fast as we could be because of that, I think, as an industry.
Hmm.
If that makes sense.
No, it totally makes sense.
It does make sense.
So, we've heard that from a lot of different points of view. I mean, basically everybody within the industry has an idea of, like, why or how it needs to grow. And then all of the readers have an idea of how or why it needs to grow.
Yeah.
Well, there's lots of ideas and, like, lots of solutions, and let's go. Let's do it. Let's
do all the things. Well, and that's a great thing, is, like, you know, the industry is growing, and it is, you know, going in that direction. It's just a matter of how quickly, you know, and I know a lot of people want it to go faster than it is, but at least it is growing, and we're not screwing ourselves over and, you know, doing the opposite.
Yeah. Well, let's kind of end things on a happy note, if you don't mind.
No, that's fine.
What are you reading these days? What do you want to recommend to the audience? What should people be checking out?
Oh, that is a good question. I just picked up the first issue of Wicked and the Divine, which
well,
is
perfect.
Really...
We're talking about issue 4 in this very episode.
Oh, perfect. I won't have heard what you guys said about it already.
Obviously not.
Obviously not. But, you know, I love the first issue, and it, you know, unfortunately hit too close to something I was wanting to do at some point, but, you know, who knows, a decade from now I could revisit it.
They pulled a Morrison.
Yeah, right? every time. What else am I reading? Hold on. Let's see. Unfortunately, I had to, like, pull back on my pull list just because so many series are ending. Like, Fatale, I'm still, like, I have the issues. I just haven't read it yet, but I was really loving that.
Yeah, that's great. I was hooked on that in issues from the beginning. I can definitely second that recommendation.
Yeah. Saga, obviously, although I think, is that on hiatus right now?
I think the most recent issue was the last for the next couple of...
Yeah, it's doing their trade skip month.
Yeah.
Okay. I just picked up the first volume of Gotham Central, but I haven't read that yet.
Hmm.
With well, the whole
good timing for
still.
That.
Yeah. I really enjoyed Midas Flesh.
Yeah, that was
good. That was so good.
Yeah. And it definitely, like, I liked the whole like grounded in science lecture that we got in it, just to like, you know, kind of solidify that, no, we know what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. That was awesome. Dave, I really enjoyed, which is digital first. I don't know if that's getting a trade treatment or not.
It really should. And if people are looking for that digitally, it's D4VE.
Yeah. Yep. Superior Foes of Spider-Man. I just read the first trade of that and really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. So fun.
Yeah, and that's one thing that I kind of feel like is easy, or I know I'm not the only one to think that, like, we need more fun in comics again. And I think after Guardians of the Galaxy, people kind of realize that a little bit more, where it's like, oh yeah, fun. I remember fun.
Right?
Yeah. Not all grim and gritty and dark and serious and somber and all that stuff. So, which again, like, I think that's the great thing about Sensation Comics, is that like they're giving us that freedom to do whatever outside of the New 52. So we're not, you know, all grim and gritty and grim.
Unless you're actually writing the grim comic book.
Yeah, which is fine. You're allowed to. There's mm-hmm. nothing wrong with that. It's just for me as a writer, I'm kind of over it.
Mm-hmm.
I say as I finish a post-apocalyptic pitch.
This can still be fun.
But the fun kind, right?
Yeah.
Not lighthearted. We'll put it that way.
Sounds like no. Well, thank you again to Sean E. Williams for joining us on the couch this week. Thank you to all of you for listening to another episode of Comics Therapy. Don't forget to pre-order your comics at your local shop and subscribe to them digitally. Even the dog agrees that you guys should be doing this. Come on. Show notes and other details are on our site, as always, comicstherapy.com. We will see you next week.
When the music's over, when the music's over, yeah.